Sure thing. So I'm Peter Thompson. I'm a wildlife biologist. I currently live in Vancouver, British Columbia, and I'm affiliated with the School of Environmental Science at Simon Fraser University. I grew up on the east coast of the United States and in a pretty rural area, and there was not much else to do besides walk around in the woods and look at wildlife. So I grew that appreciation from a very young age, and particularly for the diversity of different kinds of living things that you can find and interact and watch and experience and share a space with. So that appreciation came about at a really young age and has stayed with me for my entire life. I originally got my bachelor's degree in statistics and built kind of a quantitative data analysis background, and then eventually pursued a PhD in biological sciences at the University of Alberta, where I was able to do some interdisciplinary kind of quantitative ecology modeling work, and grew more familiar with, working with complicated data and doing work that hopefully somewhere down the line helps conserve wildlife. And ever since I finished my schooling, I've tried even harder to pursue opportunities with that goal in mind. So working on things that hopefully can help us understand how to best protect endangered wildlife, understand the animals better, how we can adjust our behavior to make their lives easier and to coexist more harmoniously with them.
And I feel like those values are really properly reflected in your paper as well. Speaking about your paper, actually, it's explained that the progress indicated from changes made on, I guess, like the ranks or levels of endangerment of certain species here in BC aren't actually accurate because they're often tied to increased efforts in surveying or like, I think you mentioned something about the reassessment of the original data. Do you think there's a reason why, amidst like growing concerns regarding the protection of endangered species, why is it that we're kind of backtracking, that we're seeing such little actualized progress?
Yeah, well, there's two pieces there, and the first thing I want to say is just to clarify that I don't like when the ranks and listing assignments of endangered species. So the BC government has this conservation data center, and they place species in either the red list, the blue list, or the yellow list, which orders from most to least endangered, based on all the existing scientific knowledge to date. They do their best job and they put it in one of those categories. And this has been done for thousands of species. And quite honestly, especially in the landscape we exist in, where wildlife don't get the attention they deserve a lot of the time, I consider it quite an admirable effort and quite a lot of work to learn really deeply about all these species and their populations in BC. Inevitably, we don't know everything, especially for like little insects, creepy crawlies, like obscure little mosses and plants. And sometimes, for example, a new population is just discovered, often by amateur naturalists. And that can completely revise the assessment, because if you were previously going on the assumption that there's only one population in BC, that would probably warrant placement on the red list. So that's kind of like our emergency room for very endangered species. But if more populations start to pop up, potentially because of increased search effort, everyone is using iNaturalist now and people are starting to look a little bit harder, and there's so much community science coming in that's really helping these initiatives. We might eventually realize, oh, this species actually was here the whole time, and we never had the ability to survey. And so you might see a change from red to blue as a result of that. So it is an inaccuracy, but it's an understandable one in the context of that's what science is about, continuing to progress forward and improve those estimates and learn more. However, the reason we focused in on those is because though that change that I just described, like, oh, we found this thing, it was here the whole time, it's clearly doing better than we thought, we're going to move it from red to blue, that would be a down listing. That is not what we called in our article a genuine change, because a genuine change would represent actual improvement in the species population over time, potentially as a result of human integration into that system, like we did something that helped protect that species. And so an example of a genuine change would be like the population actually increased across areas that we know the animal was present, and we can document that with data, or a threat that is known to be present to that species has disappeared or gone away, like industrial activity in an area has gone away, and so that threat is gone, so we consider the species less endangered. So those would be examples of genuine changes. And when we looked at the data, what we found is genuine changes, as defined by the BC CDC, were very, very rare. So they basically write a short explanation of those changes, and my co-authors and I basically read through and classified all of them as genuine or non-genuine, following that description I just made, that definition that we have in the article. And once we did that, thanks to the descriptions that were provided, we found that those genuine changes were very low, and there were only 14 genuine improvements in a 16 or 17 year time span across all of BC. So there were some improvements. Almost all of them were non-genuine. And when you filter out those non-genuine changes, what we see is the most common thing happening. If a species was on the red list in 2008, when we started our data analysis, it is still on the red list today in 2026. That is the most common outcome.
Kind of related to that and also part of your paper, I was surprised to also only see that there were only like four legally protected species in BC as well, considering, yeah, so many are just already at risk at a federal level, maybe even international level. You also mentioned something about like the creepy crawlies, I guess, like the ones overlooked, like the ghost species. I think it was
Yeah.
specifically mentioned in the paper tarantulas, I want to say.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, yeah, I before we started doing this study, I didn't even know we had tarantulas in BC.
Me
They're dwarf
neither.
tarantulas, to be fair, but they are in that classification. So the legal landscape of wildlife conservation in BC is really complicated. You're right that the closest thing we have to a provincial Species at Risk Act is the Wildlife Act, which is I think it's almost 3 decades old at this point, and it protects 4 species. And those are, I think, Vancouver Island Marmot, the White Pelican, the Sea Otter, and the Burrowing Owl. So there's like it's a small sample, and reptiles, fish, plants, insects, invertebrates are, of course, completely unrepresented in that group of four. It's just 2 mammals and 2 birds. And the Wildlife Act for the species that are protected certainly has some good provisions. It's not the only act that affects wildlife in BC. There's, of course, the Federal Species at Risk Act, which is pretty well established and does a lot of good things, and it's a great thing that it's there, but it only impacts federal land, like national parks or other federally owned land, and that land only makes up about 1% of British Columbia. So a lot of species that are red listed in BC might also be listed under the Species at Risk Act federally, but that law only applies on federal land. And that's why a Provincial Species at Risk Act could be really transformative, to basically take the provisions included in some of these other laws and expand them to a wider breadth of species and regions. And even with other legislation, there's also like the Forest Range Practices Act, I think it's called, FRPA, FRPA, which is also pretty limited in scope because it's aimed at forestry. And then there's things like the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, which is obviously limited to migratory birds and has pretty limited provisions. Like it's mostly just, you can't step on a nest and crack the eggs and kill it sort of thing. So there's a lot of gaps, and particularly I like to mention the creepy crawlies. I'm not specifically a creepy crawly biologist, but I like to mention them because they really don't get the attention they deserve, and insects as a whole are declining massively worldwide, in large part because of pesticides used in agricultural areas. And they are a really important component of every ecosystem where they live because they make food for so many things. They carry out important ecosystem services like decomposing things and so on. And so without insects, our ecosystems would be very unrecognizable and they would fail to function in a healthy way. And we're seeing massive declines across the board for insects as a group, and many of them do not get the attention that they deserve to be put on these lists that are currently in place.
Yeah, I mean, is that, I know you mentioned how insects are overlooked like worldwide, but is that also a common pattern across Canada as well? Like these species at risk acts essentially not being updated quickly enough or you know, being outdated basically.
Yeah, and I think one thing that makes it hard, and I shouldn't just say insects, because then the other, there are other invertebrates, of course, like really anything that doesn't have a backbone, that's not a fish, reptile, amphibian, mammal, or bird, is often left out of the conversation. And the biggest difficulty there is there are so many species of these things. Like worldwide, we have about 11,000 birds and maybe like about 6,000 mammals, roughly speaking, and even just for insects, we're talking millions of insect species and millions of other species of invertebrates. And so the scale is difficult because it takes a lot of work to get anything on the Species at Risk Act, and that system is not perfectly refined, but it basically requires a species to be recommended by an expert panel of scientists, goes through a scientific assessment courtesy of something called COSIWIC, which is basically a committee of expert scientists that volunteer their time to recommend and assess species. And they come out with their assessment that follows this very strict set of criteria, and then it goes through review in the federal government, where they weigh the socioeconomic constraints, and then ultimately, if those are deemed negligible, it goes on the list. But a difficult part of that, and sorry, this is a bit of a tangent, but a difficult part of this, because this is all federal government stuff, it has nothing to do with BC, but that COSIWIC assessment, they have these really strict criteria about basically we have to be really sure that it is endangered in Canada. And with many insects and other invertebrates, we just don't know very much. So they don't always pass muster in that very strict assessment environment, and we end up with these species where what we really need is to collect more data and to learn more about where they are. Otherwise, they're just going to keep not being recommended because we can't make a good case. And that's where we see those species being left off across the board, because the less we know about them, the harder it is to make a compelling evidence-based case that this species is for sure endangered and deserves that status on the Species at Risk Act.
So it's really a surveying issue with the like invertebrates, basically.
Yeah, a survey, like it's just a very hard problem because there's so many. So like, for example, I feel pretty confident, like based on my skills and experience, that you could place me anywhere in BC and I could identify most of the birds around me, because in a given place there might be a couple dozen, in a given place in most areas. Insects or invertebrates, on the other hand, it's like just an order of magnitude. Like there could be, in theory, hundreds of different insects around you, and you have to know all of them, and they're tiny, so they're hard to look at, they're hard to find, they're hard to detect, and so just it's generally just a very difficult scientific problem to monitor all those species. And that, kind of goes downstream where you don't have as much data at the end of the day to make that assessment. Even if you could argue, following the precautionary principle, that you also don't have evidence that they're doing okay. And so there's that kind of touche element to it as well, where really, what these species need is we need to take the precautionary principle and protect them until we're sure that they are doing all right. And it is more and more science will be required to make sure of that.
I mean, what do you think from like what you've research for this paper, what do you think the future may hold for BC or like any part of Canada, really?
Yeah. Well, the story is pretty similar across most provinces. Most provinces do not have provincial species at risk legislation, or if they do, they have kind of started to deteriorate it and walk it back. That's been happening in Ontario recently under Doug Ford's government. Even in places with species at risk legislation, it certainly helps. But if nothing changes, the future is probably more of the same, where we have species just staying in this very uncomfortable position on the brink of extinction, and potentially some of them going extinct, at a regional level. It's quite easy to teeter on that brink for a very long time, because maybe one tiny smidge of habitat will be protected that will hold kind of an insular population for an extended period of time. So, and that species can kind of hang on the red list for a long time. But that's not, in my opinion, a healthy outcome. That's not what we should be striving for. We should not be striving for tiny little remnants of what used to be there. We should be striving for a healthy, connected, flowing ecosystem that allows for extensive populations and sufficient gene flow to keep them sustainable. And so I think if things keep going the way they are, we're just going to see more of these species teetering on the brink. And of course, the worst case scenario, if you listen to some of the leading work in climate science, is that things could shift at some point very drastically, and that would lead to massive negative influences on a lot of wildlife species in BC and around the world.
Ooh, do you have a specific example that you happen to like know off the top of your head?
Well, I won't say anything specific. I'm not an expert, but certainly a lot of the climate work involves forecasting years into the future, changes in temperature, sea levels, rainfall. Wildfire, of course, in BC is a consequence of some of those variables. And there are certainly many projections from what appears to be the leading work. As far as we can tell, these projections are quite accurate. And of course, people have been projecting exactly what's happening now for decades, so there's certainly reason to believe that. And, you know, if those projections are true, and if we keep as a planet using as much fossil fuels and producing as much emissions as we are as a planet, these things are going to continue, and we will continue to see increased, for example, variability in weather that can lead to an increased frequency of natural disasters that can affect wildlife and people. Wildfire included in that, as a result of massive dry periods and dry winters and all the variability that comes from there. And as these things get more extreme, it becomes more likely that these sorts of events, mass die-offs of for example, food crops or food species, food plants in the environments as a result of unfavorable climatic conditions, those things are projected to be more likely to happen, and wildlife are going to suffer as a result, because they're going to run out of things to eat, they're going to run out of places to make their nest and sleep and hide. And so it's certainly, taking that view, it's quite concerning.
With these stakes in mind, what do you think is like the first step that we should be doing at a provincial level? Of like, you know, what we should be changing about our current management strategies, for example.
Yeah, well, if I had my way, I think taking something like the Wildlife Act and potentially adding some additional provisions to habitat. So the Wildlife Act is mainly focused on hunting, as I recall. I'm not a lawyer, but I've kind of glossed through these things. And it's mostly related to you cannot kill the animal, you cannot remove the animal from where it lives, you cannot harm it. But I think also that habitat piece is really important. You know, if you cut down an animal's habitat but don't touch the animal itself, like if you cut down the tree where it lives, or, you know, mow down the grassland where it lives, even if you don't kill the animal, you're effectively sentencing it to death because it doesn't have what it needs to survive anymore. So having that habitat piece in provincial species at risk legislation is really important. And then just even having, I think something that mirrors the Federal Species at Risk Act, like it doesn't have to be groundbreakingly different from that, but just something that can apply on federal land, something that is enacted by the provincial government so they have the jurisdiction to enforce it on provincial land, would be a game changer because that's a much bigger piece of the pie from a geospatial perspective. So taking something like that and having protections for not just the animals and plants and everything in between, but their habitats is really important in my opinion.
And like for our listeners, what do you think we could be doing more of as a community?
Well, there's a few different directions that somebody could take there. Obviously, like if we're thinking about climate change, there are ways that we can all become more sustainable. I am once again not an expert in that, but reducing your personal carbon footprint, there are a lot of ways to do that. Even in BC, where a lot of electricity comes from hydropower, like even just being mindful of how much energy we use. And not wasting energy, not using it if it's not necessary, not wasting food. There's of course a lot on the internet about how to reduce one's carbon footprint, so I won't go too far into that, but obviously those things help wildlife. And then on the legislative side, like I would encourage people to talk to their local politicians, the local member of legislative assembly. You'd be surprised how likely they are to respond to you. You can once again Google and figure out who your local MLA is in BC, and just ask them what they're doing and show them that you care about this, because ultimately, like politicians, their number one goal is to get elected, and if there are enough people that make noise about this and show that they care and tell their local MLA that they care, that will go a long way towards encouraging politicians to pass this sort of legislation, something like what I was describing. Like, I think a lot of times politicians are in a really tough spot because they want to make all of these changes, but so many of them will come at the cost of votes, and then they get kicked out, and then they aren't able to do anything. So they're really working hard to do the best they can, and I think they care a lot more about these issues than a lot of people might assume, but they're just really constrained by doing what they believe is sort of good politically and will retain votes. So making it clear that people care about wildlife, that we care about this, that we want to conserve wildlife in BC. We don't want everything sitting on the red list forever. And making sure people know that and making noise about it is really important if we want to encourage the creation of legislation similar to what I'm describing.
And that's a beautiful note to end on. Before we end the interview, we always try to give the opportunity for guests to share other interests or future projects that they're currently working on. So I guess as the closing question for today, is there any future plans we should be looking out for?
Yeah, well, my colleagues and I we've also done some investigation along sort of similar lines about the Federal Species at Risk Act, which in that case it's different because the act exists, but we're doing some work. I won't say too much until it's, through the scientific peer review process, but doing some work basically assessing how often species get added to the list and whether that process can be made more efficient. So that's certainly something I'm really excited about, and hopefully we can get out, and that can make a big difference.
And on that note, thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you, Florentina, for the chat, and I appreciate you reaching out.
To CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Oh, sir. What are they singing? To be or not to be?
This is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. The Honeybee Center in Surrey, BC was buzzing more than usual on May 20th, which is also known as World Bee Day. The Honeybee Center is a honey farm and hub for honeybee education, and as part of the City of Surrey's environmental extravaganza, the Honeybee Center hosted a World Bee Day celebration at their farm location in Surrey. Surrey's environmental extravaganza takes place from April 22nd on Earth Day to June 8th on World Ocean Day, and includes over 100 free environmental programs and events for residents to explore throughout the city. CJSF took a trip down to the Honeybee Center for World Bee Day, where we were greeted by Cassie Jabot, educator, beekeeper, and owner of the Honeybee Center.
Yeah, so Honeybee Center was founded by my father-in-law about 22 years ago, John, and his concept was providing pollination services to blueberry growers in the Fraser Valley, and as a side effect of that, we have monofloral honey, so we're able to produce blueberry blossom honey or cranberry blossom honey because we put our bees in that field. So the farmer gets a pollination service and we get a monofloral honey. And so since then, we've evolved into sort of being a start-to-finish business. So my specific role is I provide education. I do mostly field trips throughout the school year. I see about 250 groups a year. But then we also do lots of programming for adults, families, etc. And so today, we're celebrating World Bee Day.
Jabot also sees the educational resources provided by the Honeybee Center as a gateway for kids to become more interested in the environment and environmental stewardship.
Yeah, so our main program that we run all through the school year is, I call it a basic bees program. It's our field trip program. So basically we're teaching lots of different things about honeybees and other bees, with the end goal being creating better environmental stewards. So working with kids to give them information and make them curious about bees and insects and the environment, because we believe that the curiosity will turn to action. And so we want to just create these humans that are going to save our planet. And our angle, of course, is bees, because, you know, we're a bee company, but we also understand that without bees, we'd have less food, or food would be more expensive. And it's sort of just, it's just the start of looking at the environment when you're working with bees. Yeah.
Of course, we did come down to the Honeybee Center for World Bee Day, so we also talked about what the Honeybee Center had to offer for those in attendance.
So today we have 11 exhibitors, so a Surrey Invasive Plant Removal, the Avian Research Bird Center, we've got the Clayton Seed Library, Metro Vancouver, Regional Parks. Girl Guides are here. So we've got 11 different vendor tables. Throughout the afternoon, we're going to have story times, bee-themed story times. And at 4 o'clock, the big show will be a beekeeping demonstration. So we'll open up one of our beehives and get people to have an inside look at what's happening in a hive. And again, like I say, hopefully make them curious about bees.
There is a lot to learn about honeybees. Yet, there is still a fear that many have when it comes to interacting and being around swarms of bees like you might find on a honey farm. Here is what Cassie Jabot had to say about those concerns.
So one of the things I lead with for children is, are you planning to act like a bear? And as long as you don't act like a bear, then the bees are going to leave you alone. They're more scared of us than we are of them. And I think that social media makes us scared of things. But really, bees are only harming us when they feel like they're in danger. Of course, you know, we don't know if we've accidentally stepped on their home or what's leading to their fear. But I tell people, just stay still, stay calm, breathe slowly, move away, because really you're probably more likely to get hurt by a cat than you are a bee. And I think, again, like I said, it's about sort of slowing your body down, respecting the environment. Everything has a purpose. And then being a little bit more curious, trying to be more curious than scared at the end of the day.
For those that are curious, you can find out more about the Honeybee Center at honeybeecenter.com. You can also visit their farm location in Surrey, BC, which is open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. This has been Danny Nesvetarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.